Hi, and welcome to this episode of the VFX Show. I'm Mike Seymour, joined by Matt Wallen and Jason Diamond. How are you guys?
Matt, very good.
Smashing.
Yeah, all good. So this is a film this week that we're proud, I guess, to be reviewing at many levels because it's called The Fall Guy. Interestingly, it has been also held up as an example of why we're in the death throes of cinema. But I guess from our point of view, it's kind of a love letter to stunt people. But it's bizarre that at the same time that it's this kind of shining example of people that really care about cinema, that it hasn't gone well at the box office and its failure to go well at the box office has been held up as the, I don't know, the canary in the cave of the fact that cinema is dead. So a lot to talk about this week. And of course, as much as there are stunts, there's still visual effects. So let's mm-hmm. get into it. Jason, what did you think of the film itself, just as a film?
I think I've mentioned this before, but I was lucky enough to see it at South by Southwest at the mm-hmm. I think it was the world premiere. They held it for that, and you know, and all the stunt people were there, and all the most of the cast, and the trailer made me not that interested, quite frankly. I was like, I don't know. Like, sure, I'll see it. I like Gosling. I like Emily. Like, I like the people in it, but I loved it. Like, the energy, certainly at the film festival, always is like double what a normal theater would be because everyone's just so pumped. But like, the jokes, the music, the fact that Kiss's "I Was Made for Loving You" was not only the theme song, but also the score sort of theme, which I thought was amazing. It's a really good movie about movies, which is hard to do because it's inside baseball. And I think they did the Pixar thing where they could have, you know, like kids and adults like it. And here it's like movie people and movie nerds liked it, as well as, like, I'll use the term civilians, could enjoy the love story and all the sort of peek behind the scenes, but you didn't have to kind of know it for it to work.
Tell me this, how many stunties were at your screening in South by Southwest? Because I went to the Australian premiere and it was shot in Australia.
Yeah.
So there were a lot of stunties. Mm-hmm. I'm going to post in the show notes a picture, but like there was like loads of
I'll give you a picture of mine too. Stunties. They didn't have the stunt people on the stage. They were like, hey, stunt guys, stand up in the audience. It was like all the most handsome dudes stood up, you know, and you're like, oh, right, look at these guys. And everybody clapped for them, and they were all wearing the same outfit. They all had the jacket and the jeans and the Timberlands and whatever. But on stage was all the cast, almost all the cast except for Aaron Taylor Johnson and maybe one or two other people were there. So like Gosling. And I stood next to Gosling in the aisle while I was walking next to my seat, and he's a very handsome man. So,
Matt, what did you think?
Yeah, I feel like it. Whenever I see Ryan Gosling, it's weird. It's like looking in a mirror. But
when I look at Emily Blunt. But anyway,
yeah,
go on.
It's like based on an '80s TV show, right?
Yeah,
so The Fall Guy, which I loved. Starred Lee Majors and I think Heather Thomas.
Yep.
I can't remember. This
is Lee Majors post Bionic Man.
Exactly. Yep. Post $6 Million Man, post his marriage as being Mr. Farrah Fawcett. But yeah, like I was never like really super into the TV show as a kid in the 80s. I think I watched it a few times. So, I mean, I kind of knew the drill.
It.
But yeah, it was like, It was really kind of an interesting premise. I think I'd agree with Jason. I wasn't super excited based on the first trailer, but you know, Ryan Gosling just as an actor, you know, coming off of Barbie and the kind of phenomenal success of that film, and then his performance at the Oscars doing his "I'm Just Ken" or whatever song. And you know, there's something about his Saturday Night Live appearances and stuff. He's really funny. He's very funny. And he's got a real gift for comedic timing and being somewhat self-deprecating. And, you know, it's hard. You just kind of can't help but like the guy. And so, you know, my wife wanted to go see it. And I'm like, well, okay, sure, I'll go check it out. And, you know, I didn't have any real high expectations going into it, but it was great. I thought it was so much fun. You probably could have cut 15 minutes out of it.
Sure. I mean, that's, yeah.
But like, it still, I mean, I didn't care. Like, it was so much fun. It was really funny. There was great action set pieces in it. And the visual effects, actually, the stunts are amazing, obviously, like that's kind of the whole thing. And then it made me want to go back and work on a movie again and be like in that movie culture, which was, you know, it's so specific. And if you've ever worked on a film, be it in production mm-hmm. or post-production, you know, that vibe, that set vibe is so real. And it's so fun. Like there's a scene where the assistant, like, I don't know if he's an AD or an assistant to the director or something.
Yeah.
And he's like, traveling. And he nervously walks across, you know, to give the megaphone. And they have that scene with the megaphones, which is so great. I think the thing though, that I really found fascinating, in it from a perspective of visual effects is that one of the things that they do, aside from the visual effects that are kind of, would they be non-diegetic? Is that right? Like, because they're supposed to be real, right?
The real world visual effects.
The sound term, you know? And, but the stuff that I thought was really cool, and I kind of love it as an idea, and I think as an effects artist, it would be so cool to be given the assignment of like, okay, we're going to do some effects, but they kind of need to look like visual effects. They have to look kind of cheesy and they got to cheese it up a little bit. Sort of like the idea of when an actor is told in a movie, a really good actor is said, okay, we have to act badly. And so like as an effects team, it's like, you know, sort of it's anathema to like what you think about when you're an effects artist. Like if they say, mm-hmm. well, we want it to kind of look like visual effects, like a bad Extraction or kind of a not so hot comp or a face replacement or whatever.
Even outside of that, I think the mission was the audience has to immediately know it's visual effects.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Not good or bad, but it has to be able to set, the audience has to say, this is meant to your point as a movie within the movie visual effects. Mm-hmm. So when we cut back to the set and it's just like some blue screen pads and like the crew, the visual language, almost like Inception, right? You need the layers, the audience to be able to understand the layers and levels that they're totally at.
And I love that. I thought that was so great. Yeah. And it made the totality of the movie. One, it's just super fun, super entertaining. It's an original, I mean, whatever, it's based on the TV show, but for the most part, it's a totally original movie. And it's so fun. Like, I don't know why, you know, people aren't going to see it because it's awesome. It's really a fun ride. Yeah,
I don't think they needed to make it off the TV show because I don't think the TV show had much actual brand. Mm-mm. I mean, maybe that's a reflection of how you get funding, but I mean, I don't think that there was this huge pent up audience. You know, if you're making a show that was a mega hit, like, I don't know, trying to think of a mega
Baywatch.
Hit from back then. Yeah. Like if you say, oh, exactly, we're making Baywatch and everybody knew that that show was there, then it's got a lot more sort of built-in audience. I don't think this was a built-in audience thing.
No.
So yeah, I agree with you. It's effectively an original film. And of course, so it's not Ryan Gosling's first film playing a stuntman or even a stunt driver, as in he was in the film Drive. But I have to agree, comedically, like his stuff on Saturday Night Live, especially the alien abduction stuff, is just some of the funniest Saturday Night Live stuff I've ever seen.
For sure.
Like that, I mean, he of course breaks during the, you know, the life of that Saturday Night Live skit. And if you haven't seen him with the alien abduction skit on Saturday Night Live, please just YouTube it. It is the funniest thing ever. Here's the thing. I liked it a lot. I absolutely liked it, right? But I'd love to now, if we can, just for the fun of it, pick apart how wrong it was. Not because it was a bad film and not because it was wrong in a way that took you out of the film, but it wasn't very accurate, right? So let me give you a couple of quick examples and I'll see if you guys agree with me. I thought it just funny and endearing that like the first time you see his shot in the opening monologue, because you've got all these, in the opening sequence of the film, and we'll post a show note because it's online, there's a whole bunch of stunt stuff and he's narrating it as a voiceover. And those stunts are real stunts from films. Like there was a Mission Impossible stunt, for example, in that montage. And then it comes to his one where he kind of goes, oh yeah, and that's me. What I found so funny about that is it's just like an action war sequence and the camera's going to the side and it's beautifully shot, but the camera is camera left facing him and he's sort of springboarding up and ending up in the water, right? And there's a whole lot of other stunts going on behind him, which wouldn't have been on camera, right? And so it's like, if you're on set, you don't film like 50 stunties doing stuff and just film one of them and that the other 49 just going to do whatever they want. Like, so that, I thought that was funny. Like, it was just like, it was so over the top, but just not how you do it. And then the second thing that I thought was just less funny, but just, you know, how obviously how you make a film is no stuntman I know, and I don't know many stunt women, but I know quite a lot of stunt guys. No stuntman I know ever spontaneously does a stunt.
Yeah.
Like if you want to do a stunt,
that's ridiculous.
You walk it through, you map it out, you slowly go through it. It's an incredibly methodical process. It takes a really long time to get to the point that you'll do a version of it that is live and then a version of it that's live that maybe with explosions or other things going on. The reason that stunties are alive is because they're fastidious at planning and they're not cowboys. They're not gung-ho. They're not like risk-taking idiots that just like will jump off anything. And so the only thing that
And they use your most favorite thing, physics.
Physics, yes. But here's the thing, right? In the film, you kind of got the impression, especially at the end, right? They're like the sort of massive fight sequence. But you get this sort of impression, which was, you know, in the original TV show, I know, that stunties are just incredibly athletic, spontaneous guys who can just roll with anything. And if you'd had to jump in a car and flip it, they wouldn't need any rehearsal because, hey, you know, yeah, I'm just going to roll and jump a car. Whereas if we can use the car jumping sequence as an example, because it's the most, I think, insane thing about this whole film. The script says on the beach at the beginning when he arrives in Australia to do the shooting that it's an amazing car flip, a world record-breaking car flip, right? Which is a completely reasonable thing for a script to say. However, the writer has said he never meant it to actually break a world record. The implication was if it's a world record rolling of a car, then, you know, that just implies how big the shot is. And so I don't know if the most recent one, but like in the Bond film, I'm going to say one of the first of the last ones that they rolled an Aston Martin. It was Casino Royale, I guess it was. And they rolled that. And that was like a huge number of rolls. Anyway, so here they had to beat that roll. And so what I find fascinating is that they actually broke the world record, not because they absolutely needed to, but because the script said they're going to break the world record.
It was like 8.5, I think. The Leech talked about it at South By. He like pointed out the guy. The guy was like two rows behind me and he stood up and he's like, that guy rolled, that's the guy. He rolled the thing. And then like a funny Easter egg. He's like, when Gosling gets out of the car, the guy that comes up to him to be like, you did it, is the guy who actually
did it. Yeah, it's Logan. Logan Hollander is the guy that did the stunt. Yeah, 2 hours after having done the stunt is the guy that's walking out and congratulating Ryan for doing the stunt. And then Ryan apparently is like, this is so screwed up. You've just risked your life and now you're coming and congratulating me for a thing you did. But here's the thing, right? If you listen to Logan talk about the stunt, they had to have it perfect. They had to have the right tire pressure, the right pressure on the hydraulic explosion that causes the car to flip. They had to have the right amount of packed density of sand for it to come off. Like none of it is, hey, you've just arrived in Sydney, here's a car, go roll it as many times as you can. And I'm sure that no stuntie minds the impression that they're incredibly gifted genius.
It's narrative.
But having said that, it's like it didn't take me out of the film. It's just so funny, right? It's just It's like,
but that's an inside baseball, right? That's inside baseball for us.
Well, that's this,
for movie people.
That's this podcast.
Well, no, of course, of course. But I do like that Gosling's like, it's bad sand. It's bad sand. You know, like he's pointing out one of the things that they're all. And of course, you know, from the inside baseball standpoint, he drives too close, demolishes the camera on the Russian arm, and then she's. They're like, never mind, we have helicopters, we have all the other, just keep rolling, you know. And you're like, no, you'd probably like, you want that close-up shot, you know, whatever. But again, it's I do have to add that I saw it a second time with my kid when it came out. And I mean, he said the same thing. He's like, let's go see it because I came back from South By and said, oh, it was amazing. He's like, the trailers don't look very good. I was like, it'll be fun. And he came out of the movie. First of all, he's leaning into me during the movie going, is this how it is when you make, you know, like on big sets? I'm like, yeah, it's kind of close, you know. But then when we left, he's like, I want to be a stuntman. You know what I mean? He's 17. You know, it's usually what like a 12-year-old says. But he's like, oh, that looks so fun. How do I be a stuntman?
I was going to ask if either of you guys had ever seen that 1980 Richard Rush movie, The Stuntman, with Peter O'Toole and Steve Railsback.
Steve Railsback. Yeah,
I think so.
Don't think I have. A friend of mine.
It's kind of the same thing where there's like, there's a, you know, an inadvertent like death of a stuntman on a movie set. And like the director, Peter O'Toole, tries to like shelter him from the cops. And like, I mean, it's kind of cool. And it's like, it feels like it's got some of the same DNA in that, like the plot in this film where you wind up with the woman who's, I can't remember that actress's name now, but
Hannah Waddingham.
Yeah. She's great. Yeah. She's great in it, but like that she's, you know, you find out, spoiler alert, that she's kind of in on the whole thing of trying to protect her. Is it her son?
What? No, he just her, like,
it's like her
Aaron Taylor
her
Johnson. Star. No, it's like her meal ticket. Yeah. He's like the guy that she, that she built up.
And that he accidentally caused this murder, and they do have to get into doing all this stuff. But I kind of feel like that intrigue within the narrative is so, it's so great. And it's kind of weirdly secondary almost to this, you know, this relationship, this kind of romantic comedy vibe that's going on. I don't know. Just, it's so much fun. No, so many levels that it's working on as a script, I think.
Because it could have been that they focused on the stunts at the expense of the romantic comedy aspect. And then you would have had what you don't want, which is basically like a film that is taking you away from the narrative to focus on the technique. It was so much better being focused on the story and then having all this great technical stuff to do with the stunts. Because if you just had a showreel of stunts, it had got boring really quick, right?
Yeah,
it totally. But also, only mattered.
But also to your point, the sort of offhanded nature of the way they deal with the way the stunts are, not in a negative way, but just to the audience, like getting rid of the minutiae of things for the audience. So it just feels like action, 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 that they're able to use all of those, all of his skills as like fun kind of comedic fighting skills during the thing, like the, which we can talk about, like the nightclub scene with the bottles, or the scene in his, in the main star's apartment with all the props that aren't real, you know, like there's all these really funny things that allow him to, like, just as he's about to be the hero and be physical, there's a comedic thing that happens that kind of takes the piss out of him and out of the thing to let him be successful, but in a funny way while still having action, which is really hard, I think, you know, like.
Yeah, no, I agree. So I'm going to, so here's my minor claim to fame. I was actually approached by the producers of the film when it was shooting in Sydney. Do you want to know why?
Why? You know,
at the end, there's a boat sequence where they're flying around.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So I have
the
a
Miami
yacht.
Near, when he jumps the, when
the
he
Miami
jumps
Vice
the
sequence.
Thing. Yeah.
I have a yacht, and my yacht has a name. And the name of my yacht was on the name of one of the yachts that was in that sequence, right? And they contacted us to make sure we were okay with our yacht name. It wasn't our yacht, just our yacht name being displayed during that sequence, which I swear to God, you cannot see. But it was like, do you, you know, do you have any problem with signing a thing, a release that, you know, we can imply that your yacht? And I was like, no, you kidding me?
Wait, what's the name?
It's Zigzag. So I've since sold that yacht. But anyway, here's the thing. So the night show that when they're going around doing that, we were just off one side. There's an open air cinema here in Sydney. So the open air cinema, we're all sitting in an open air sort of like, you know, what you'd call a, like football stadium kind of seating. Like it's a tiered, but it's made out of scaffolding and it's temporary, right? And then they actually have the screen mounted in the water, just a few yards in from the edge of the thing. And then we all go and have dinner and then sit there. And as the sun goes down, we all watch a movie. It's a great thing to do.
That's cool.
So that faces the Opera House and thus faced exactly where they were setting up to do all that stuff. So all during the movie, we were watching the movie over to one side. You could see them setting up the stunts and getting ready for it. And of course, it was after that we left that they actually did the stuff. But because again, a lot of prep to do stuff. But it was just so meta to be like, oh, that's them over there. Because only a few weeks before that, of course, Sydney had to shut the Harbour Bridge to let Ryan
right. be
dragged across it. So we were very aware that the stunt guy was in town. But yeah, it was just heaps of fun. So yeah, we just have so looking forward to seeing when this film finally came out because, you know, spot everything basically.
I mean, it's your, I'm usually watching everyone destroy New York. This time you get to see Sydney.
I think what's cool about that too, though, is your experience of having it be like, you know, in the town that you live in, that it's actually something that you experience in this meta way, but the narrative itself is so meta in that they're, the movie they're making, right? It's Metal Storm, right? With these these goofy aliens and like these ships and like, I mean, it's so funny and it's so appropriate. It's such a kind of tentpole style aesthetic movie franchise kind of thing that has all these visual effects in it and these kind of heroic battle scenes and whatever else. But it, like even that level of meta within the story, the fact that they created all these designs and all these elements that would go into this false cinematic narrative, I think is, it, again, well, it's another thing that gives so much depth to this funny story.
And to your point, the thing I love is when they cut, when she says action and they cut to the, like the final scene while they're filmed, like the audience is like, oh, they're filming this scene, but I'm watching the final scene. It's like colored music. I mean, the Dune score joke alone. Like the first time they cut to it and you hear that lady's voice, everyone in the theater like died laughing because it's hilarious.
Yeah.
Without being like, without being negative to Dune, it's just a like, hey, isn't this funny? And it's like, that's a, that's kind of an interesting, like, it could go both ways. Again, like, there's a lot of deftness, I think, in this script. And I happen to think of the sort of like, not that they're, I'm pitting them against each other or that they do this, but in the Chad Stahelski, David Leitch sort of stuntman movie verse, because Stahelski does all the Wicks and Leitch was the stunt coordinator on the Wicks and then he got his Atomic Blonde and whatever. I prefer the Leitch model because I think Leitch is able to transcend the stuntman part and is a filmmaker and understands the sort of the nature of not shitting on Stahelski in any way, but they have different approaches. But it feels like Leitch really approaches the movie as a movie and not just set pieces. Because there's
That's what you
stuff.
Have to do, isn't it? That's what happened with the Bond franchise there for a while. It just fell into set piece after set piece after set piece with amazing stunts. But you were just like, when can we get back to the story, right? Because, you know, clearly what you're doing now is just showing off.
At the screenings you guys saw, did they have that little preamble beforehand where it was the director and Ryan Gosling sitting down and they were saying like, hey, this is a love letter to stunt performers.
I didn't get that.
Yeah, well, you went to a screening. I didn't have that at South By either, but I had Leitch come out and talk about it.
I actually, you know, I mean, I think I haven't seen that too many times. They did it for the 45th, is it the 45th anniversary of Alien or 40? The one that just happened, they did a thing with Ridley Scott and the Alvarez.
But that's a retro thing, not a new film.
Right, but I haven't, And I haven't seen that done for a new film in just a standard, because I just saw it standard theatrical release here in Richmond. And it was so interesting that the movie opened that way. And I thought, oh, that's kind of cool. It's like this kind of PR thing. It's sort of a celebration a little bit.
It's very, very respectful of stunt performers, given that the whole nature of stunt performers is that they are never seen and they are not articulated.
They did mention, so now I have to ask this because they did mention in that opening thing, and I haven't looked it up, but is it true that next year will there be an Oscar for stunt?
I think they're trying for it. I don't know if it'll happen next year. I think it's certainly, but there's a huge push for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems like a no-brainer, really, like as a category. I mean,
if you're going to have hair and makeup and costuming and other things, you should have stunts. I mean, they're all equally as important, you know?
Yeah, and quite frankly, no one's risking their life with hairspray. Like, the least you can do is let these guys have a nod, right?
Well,
like,
I mean,
crying out.
Well, I'm not adding any qualitative. Yeah.
I mean,
to
how do you
comparison.
Think this happened here? How do you think I lost? Yeah.
He said, pointing at his golden locks.
Bald head.
Hair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So you guys didn't pick up on my just earlier, but were there any other sequences that you were like, in a good way, I guess, just laughing that isn't how it is actually is in movies? I mean, for example, I found the loud hailer sequence incredibly funny. Right. But the reset time between each shot would mean a conversation wouldn't happen like that. Right. Like, if you're going to do repeat a stunt like that again and again.
Which
and again,
one?
You just the loud hailer scene on the beach when she's first, she keeps on ordering go again, go again.
Yeah. And Ryan when he's just like getting thrown against the rock over.
Oh, yeah. And getting lit on fire. Yeah.
Yeah. You're not going to. I mean, I thought it was great. I thought it worked really great in the movie. I take nothing away from it. But, I mean, you just don't reset that quick.
You could have
a conversation that would continue either side of a stunt, right?
Right, but maybe that's if like somebody putting was, the...
Yeah, but was there any other of those that, like, you were like, kind of like, it's great, but hang on a second.
I mean, it's kind of funny when he shows up on set and they put him in the thing and he's scanned in, like, 2 seconds.
Yeah.
You know, like, the thing's just coming up and it's like, you know, Empire Strikes Back when Vader comes out of his clamshell, you know, they're like, all right, you're done. Like, you're like, oh, okay. You know? And then, you know, the visual effects lead, the Israeli girl she's like, oh, we could do this. We could do that. You know, blah, blah, blah. And they're like, oh, we'll fix it in visual effects. No, I don't want to, you know, this. And then, you know, here, break into this phone. You're good with tech. You know, there was like that kind of stuff.
And but, also you know, the fall that is the sort of the inciting incident where he's injured, mm-hmm. you know, that one too, I think feels like he's just kind of walking in, he's talking on the phone, he's doing multiple things. He's talking to
when the guy tells him to change it, like on the fly. Oh, right. You want me to go from the front?
Which is like,
oh, okay, sure.
No,
I'll just turn around. Click.
Yeah. I also have to say, I did like too that, I think this is the first time in an actual movie that I can think of. I know I've experienced it in real life, but where the visual effects supervisor was part of the evil plan, right? I mean, it's kind of great that the visual effects supervisor was roped into and seemed perfectly content participating in the cover up of the star's crime.
Hey, that fall with Ryan Gosling at the beginning of the film, as I understand it, I mean, obviously without the injury, that was Ryan Gosling going down from that great height.
Oh, wow.
As I understand it, and I'm pretty sure this is true, he, you know, I mean, they strapped him in and he didn't have to do much, right? He just, you know, went down. And of course, it stopped well short of him hitting the deck. But that was one of the few things that he actually did. And I was just, because there's a bunch of face replacement in this film where they're digitally swapping out Ryan Gosling or swapping in Ryan Gosling's face. But I don't think that was one of them. I think that was actually the actor with sunglasses on going down.
It seems reasonable. Yeah.
Well, reasonable, but I bet I would be pretty nervous doing that. I would be glad that I would
Me too.
But if you watch closely in the clip, the amount of grip he's got on the hand of the guy that's helping him out, it's like, this is not like someone holding on in kind of like a sensible way, like you would if you're in favor of a big mat and a green screen. This is like white knuckle holding onto the guy's hands as he's been moved out. And I was like, I got to think that's real. And from what I have researched, I think that it is. So if you guys are listening and you think that I've got that wrong, let me know. But because of course, Ryan Gosling didn't do most of the stunts in the film, but I think it was nice that he did that one.
And they do a really good job of, I mean, to switch over to the visual effects, like I certainly did not notice any like crazy digital double stuff. Like, I believe it seems like they, being a movie about stuntmen, did, orchestrated the set pieces to have actual stunts happening. I mean, I'm sure there's digital doubles. You just can't, they're not super obvious because they're not doing crazy stuff.
A lot of rig removal.
Sure, of course. I mean, that would make a lot of sense. But the Yeah, because I saw behind the scenes stuff of like him on Sydney Harbour Bridge and in town when they're in the dumpster that's spinning and whatever, which is a cool set piece. But
that was a good sequence. Yeah.
Yeah. One of my favorite things, which is all, I mean, it's visual effects, but it almost feels like more motion graphics, was when he gets drugged in the club. Like, I thought it was so kind of subtle without being like your standard, like chromatic aberration. Everything's going, I'm drugged. And then adding the gag of the unicorn, you know, like, how do I know it rears off when you stop seeing a unicorn? Like, that's an amazing thing. Cause half the time they just literally, I mean, there were digital unicorns at certain points. Obviously it was clear, but there's plenty of times when there's just a horse standing next to him. And like, it's such a, again, I will use Inception as a sort of reference point, these visual language cues for the audience to know within the plot that something hasn't changed yet, because they've been told by the character, when you stop seeing unicorns, you won't be on drugs anymore. And then they randomly bring a unicorn in like 10 minutes later. You're like, oh, okay. It's a joke, but it's informational to the audience.
Yeah, that's good. Hey, how did you guys feel? And I think this is one of the things that I did actually bump on the gun with the blanks sequence, given the tragedy that happened on set in real life, where the DOP was killed. Yeah. I was kind of surprised that actually stayed in the film, because it just seemed incredibly close to home, having a stunt pistol and the whole kind of implication around using that. No?
I
actually didn't think of it.
Really?
Yeah.
Because the most kind of obvious, I guess, behind the scenes incident since, I mean, there was been other horrendous incidents. I think the Twilight Zone where they killed someone, I think, with a helicopter, and there's like just been a
Well, and the crow and stuff like that. Yeah.
But certainly in recent times, that's for me anyway, the most obvious example of danger on set gone wrong that caused a fatality that was should never have happened, of course.
But there's also so many guns in the movie that it's like, I think by that point you're, I mean, look, John Wick has come out since, you know, a John Wick movie has come out since that incident on Rust. And there's, I mean, it's a bullet fest. And I understand what you're saying in terms of calling out the specific blanks.
Yeah.
But I think
with a gun
to me,
and, pointing at people
I think for me, the reason it worked in terms like not reminding me of that is because he is a stunt performer. So my brain was like, from a safety perspective, the actor would never be able to have a souvenir of a real gun, you know, that worked, but, and it would say blanks on it. And I don't know, it all worked in the logic of the film without making it seem like, oh, why would he have blanks? And I don't know, maybe I'm just trying to justify it, but it didn't bump, you know, jump out at me. I think it was, maybe that's because it was well handled, or maybe I just am insensitive to that.
I think
if you're not, I don't think it's being insensitive. I just think, like, you know, if you're caught up in the movie and you're watching the story unfold and you're being entertained, like, if you're thinking about all these external things outside of the narrative, I actually think then it would be problematic. Like, I think it actually speaks well of the film and of the filmmaking that you're just in the story, and the outside universe, which is kind of what I look for when I go to the movies, like, it doesn't really intrude into my entertainment, you know? And so I think it's fair, and I don't think it's not insensitive. I mean, I think any reasonable person, certainly any one of us, like, would be, you know, is appalled by what happened on the set of the Rust series, but it's like,
I think this film if we can just talk about it for a second, while it hasn't gone well at the box office, and this was hailed as like the death of cinema, and I'll loop back on that specific point, I think it's going to go gangbusters when it goes onto streaming. I think this mm-hmm. is the sort of film that'll have real totally. Legs, that people will like recommend it to friends and discover it and be like, oh my God, why didn't I see this? But going in, I would have said it was going to be a gangbuster hit. I mean, coming off mm-hmm. the back of the, you know, Barbie Oppenheimer thing totally. And just the general buzz around how good Ryan Gosling was. And then they seemed to do a really good marketing job with promoting the film. Like I saw lots of very innovative kind of social media type posts mm-hmm. that all seemed really clever. I can't explain what didn't go well, but I guess my question to you is, do you think that is the hallmark that people just don't want to go and see films? Because somebody pointed out, if this had been made in the 80s and it had Kevin Costner in the lead role and it had, like, you know, I don't know, Julia Roberts or whatever as the female lead, like two big stars of the day, you'd have been guaranteed of people seeing this at the cinema. Like, just, well, no just how doubt,
ridiculous. Even if it hadn't got, like, good reviews. The Bodyguard was a huge hit with Kevin Costner yeah. and Whitney Houston. You know, it's like, and it's kind of a behind the scenes kind of idea of a celebrity and a bodyguard or whatever, and this love affair or whatever. But yeah, I mean, it's a great analogy. I don't know. I keep thinking about, like, whether or not, is it just this ephemeral thing of like the magic of timing and of word of mouth? Are movies really dying? Is it because the price of a ticket? Is it because the expense of popcorn? Like, what is the issue that keeps people from going? I know. And this is totally anecdotal, but looking at my students, looking at like my own kid and his friends, like they go to the movies. They just, you know, they went and saw Challengers, you know, like they go and see stuff that's coming out all the time.
My students absolutely do not. Like, I will bring up references of movies, and if it's at the cinema, like, and I'll say, has anyone seen, you know, the new X? And they'll be like, no one will put their hand up. Like, it's
interesting.
They'll watch stuff streaming. They'll watch stuff on their phones, but they just,
yeah.
I think it's the expense, but anyway.
Could be.
I mean, yeah, I mean, it's possible. I do think there is, I think movies, all movies that do really well, there is, like, blockbuster movies were the original viral hit, right? Like, true. If you want to use virality as a metric. And there is a glut of content now, and when someone goes, oh, I do or I don't want to do this, do I want to go to the movies and do this, or do I want to stay home, or do I want to go to a bar and a restaurant instead of spending that, and we'll watch it when it comes out on streaming? Because there is, it's not an 8-month window anymore for streaming. Sometimes it's, I think Fall Guy was announced for, I mean, streaming, like $20 to watch it at home, but with 8 people sitting on the couch watching it, that's, you know, and your own, whatever you have in your kitchen is a little more palatable. Do I think that the Fall Guy has to be seen on a big screen? Maybe not. I mean, if you know, it's not an experience film. I prefer
to. Yeah, but I'm willing to bet all the money in my pocket, not knowing your personal living room, that you've got a big screen in your living room. So the idea of it being a big screen.
65 inches, yeah.
Because back in the day, like, that difference between, I remember that when they re-released Star Wars, they had this promo in the cinemas. They had TV showing Star Wars. This little TV was like a 4x3 telly. And it was like, you know, see Star Wars. And then it just boomed out to like scope level kind of thing. And you were like, yeah, that's what I want. I want to see it properly.
Yeah.
But now that's not really the case, is it? I mean, I'm sure you guys, Matt's the same. We've got big TVs and pretty good sound systems. And
okay, I'm gonna read you something that a friend sent me today, from it was this Ted Sarandos, the one of the co-CEOs of Netflix. He said this in a New York Times article. Netflix CEO, co-CEO Ted Sarandos argues that Barbie and Oppenheimer would have been just as big on Netflix. Quote, there's no reason to believe that the movie itself is better in any size of screen for all people. My son's an editor. He watched Lawrence of Arabia on his phone. First of all, what the fuck? Second of all, that is exactly you, like, answering the question. Like, the fact that the guy who founded and owns a company dedicated to movies and content would not sit down with his kid in probably his home theater. That's 120-inch projection, I'm sure, because he's a very wealthy man, and watch Lawrence of Arabia. Meanwhile, his kid's watching it on a tiny phone. That's, you know, one of the premier cinema experiences. You know, again, I don't judge. People can do what they want. But, like, to me, that's a really dumb statement.
It is overall a dumb statement. But here's the thing. I like the event of going out. So I recently went to an IMAX screening of the new Mad Max Furiosa, and we probably do a show about that coming up. But it's not just the size of the screen, which is one thing. I'm going to sort of argue against myself now. The thing that I like about going out to the cinema is, A, it's the going outness of it. Like, you know, you go with your partner and you kind of have dinner and stuff. But then the other thing is, you don't pull your phone out. You're not got, you know, a magazine on your lap.
Exactly.
You're not kind of like doing anything else. You're not like walking in and out of the room, and, you know, someone's not chatting on. It's just,
and it's communal.
Yeah.
There's hopefully, if this theater is full, that is the experience. You hear other people laughing at stuff. You laugh at stuff. Everybody goes, oh, or screams or whatever. That is the, I think, the inherent nature of the movie going.
Yeah. It commands experience. Your attention in a way. Yeah.
Yeah.
But then none of us are like, you know, 18, 25-year-old kind of age bracket, which is the movie blockbuster market that used to drive that, right? When I was that age.
Exactly.
Me and my mates would always go and see a new movie. We'd queue to see these new movies, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know.
I think there are people who still do. I just think, I think the biggest difference is that we're in a much more diffuse media market. There's so many more things competing for your attention, you know, the tiny rectangle in your pocket, right? But then everything that's on TV, everything that's on every streaming service, which is high quality, you know, some
that's another good point, isn't it? Yeah.
But I mean, there's great, I mean, like, stuff with great visual effects, like, you know, things that are really engrossing stories, rich character development.
We just talked about one.
Yeah. Shogun. Yeah.
Yeah,
there's no way that felt like it was a inferior narrative, inferior storytelling, inferior visuals, or inferior cinematography.
Although, wouldn't that have been cool to see on a really big screen?
But it had to have been a shorter story.
Yeah, that's
You'd have true. Had to have cut out a lot more.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is also weird in the fact that people will binge things, right? Like, you know, something comes out and they watch like nearly all the eps at
once. Well, you hear people who I've met people who are like, I don't really like going to the movies. I don't have the attention span for a movie, you know, but they'll be like, did you see this series? I watched it in 2 days. And you're like, wait, I don't understand.
How could you
watch 10 hours of content in 2 days, but you can't
don't
watch
you
a
have
2 hour
a job?
Movie. Yeah. Well, there's weekends. Come on, Matt.
Yeah.
So it's true. So getting back to this film then. So I don't think we've gotten any closer to resolving why audiences didn't see it, other than obviously we think people should have.
I think it's just a zeitgeist thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, certainly for us, right? This was like movie, you know, like it was like therapy, right? Seeing stuff on set. I mean, I loved Matt's comment about wanting to go back on set, right? Like, there is a vibe on set. Yeah.
Hanging around, just the gallows humor of being in, you know, working on a project with a big group of people, you all share the same goal, you all have different jobs. Like, sometimes, you know, some of the stuff you're doing is so ridiculous, you know, but it's so much fun, and that camaraderie and that kind of feeling
and
like you all have a shared purpose, you know, I think is really something
creative
special.
Problem solving. Like, you're on the set and you're like,
absolutely.
Somebody suddenly says, what if we do this? And you're like, okay, if you do that, and then that wipes to that, then I can get a thing from that angle, and then that would be fine. And we've got that. I love that. Yeah, I know. But having said
let me just add, I did like the fact that in the beginning of the movie, Jodi is set up as like the number one A camera operator. You know, she's doing her shit, and then she's given her big break to be a director. Like, the sort of journeyman nature of journey person nature of film as well. You know, you make your bones and come up, and you get those chances as you move through the ranks. It's a little different now with like creator culture and like that stuff, but But I like that that was in there subtly. And of course, it speaks of any industry. People come, you know, bottom up into a lot of industries. And so people who aren't movie people can get that thing. But all of us who are movie people are like, yes, of course. Like, you know, she's been behind the lens the whole time. She should be the directing, you know.
Well, it's like reading Sidley Lumet's Making Movies, you know. I mean, most anybody who's gone to film school or who's a film, you know, aficionado or whatever, has read that Sidney Lumet book. And like, you know, it's similarly a love letter to filmmaking and is such an intimate description of all the different jobs, roles, portrayals, and the way in which the sort of interpersonal politics and dynamics with all the different people from all the different, whether it's the Teamsters, you know, driving someone to set and then like hanging out at craft services and waiting till they drive them home late at night, or, you know, whether it's the star, the writer, like hiding, you know, like at the first day's read, like, cause you know, nothing's been shot yet. So they're waiting to see, you know, if there's a problem. It's the writer's problem, you know.
Like, yeah.
And he goes into all the different roles on set, and it's such a rich tableau of an universe of creativity. It's really cool. And I think this movie, in a lighthearted, fun way, kind of imbues that same energy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Matt Sloan was the production VFX supervisor. So I want to just not have a VFX show where we're not like giving shout outs to the actual VFX artists, because it was so well integrated that we've spent most of our time not talking about it. So Framestore did like, I think 130 something, maybe 140 shots. CineSite did a whole lot. And Rising Sun Pictures, I believe, did the face swapping, like the that we talked about, and also Crafty Apes. By the way, Crafty Apes, I don't know about you guys, but like those guys, they deliver. Like we haven't spoken a lot about Crafty Apes, but like the number of times we bump on stuff and just being really good. And then if you look behind the scenes, like who it is, and they do stuff like the holdovers and stuff that's like not, you know, the sort of super high. I mean, they do things like the Continental, and they've worked on, you know, more visual effects-y kind of films, but
They remind me a lot of, they're a lot like, the New York, Richard Friedlander, and I can't remember the other guy's name right off the top of my head, but Brainstorm Digital that does a lot of television work. Crafty Apes is kind of, in my mind, a similar company. They're doing like really cool work, super like significant work, but in movies, whereas I think Brainstorm tends to work more on episodic and stuff that's shooting in New York, but it's a similar kind of vibe where when you find out they did it, you're like, wow, that's great work. Like, that's so cool. I didn't know that was an effect.
Or even like Stargate. Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
Or even like Sam Nicholson over at Stargate. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, not taking anything away from CineSite and Framestore and stuff who are like,
no, of course.
Really, really good. But it's just, I guess, because CineSite and people have been going for like 30 years, they kind of more embedded. I just thought Crafty Apes kind of deserved a shout out because I just getting like people going, you know what, these guys are really good. I mean, CineSite now is more than CineSite, right? Like it's all of the, you know, Image Engine and Trickster and blah, 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 as all of these companies tend to be. But and in fact, Rising Sun Pictures is what, who are they part of now? Anyway, but I thought they did a really good job. And I thought that it's just testament to how much we liked the film and how much we were engrossed in the stories that we've been talking about, that we weren't at any point bumping on the visual effects. And as you said so eloquently, Jason, we also had to have the visual effects that we as the audience could tell were visual effects without being inherently horrible, but also not inherently seamless. It was a nice line to walk.
I think my favorite section, I mean, other than like the introduction of the first time they do it, when you get it and you're like, oh, that's what they're doing. That's awesome. Right. Just from a understanding standpoint, but from an execution standpoint, not quality execution, but story beat execution. When they do, they're like, are you game to do like we have 3 hours to shoot this crazy wonder in front of, you know, the Sydney Opera House, and they're doing it. They have the rain and the stuff, and they're like, it's a total montage. She's camera operating. And it's funny because I saw a friend of mine from Panavision after I had seen it at South By, and I was like, have you seen Fall Guy yet? He was like, no. I was like, man, it's like a Panavision commercial. Because in like half the shots are just big, you know, Millennium XLs or whatever film cameras. But when they're doing that like camera on a wire sequence and they're fighting in the rain and then they're doing quick fixes and like whatever on the oneer and they're workshopping through it in the way you were saying, Mike, about like, what if I do this and then you do that, we can have this. And they're cutting really well and fast between the shooting of it, the visual effectsness, final shots of it in that sequence. Like for me, that was like a really, really, really successful sequence.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, just to give a couple more shout outs as to what we, because we didn't do them. I didn't want to interrupt you before. CineSite was behind your, you know, drugged in the whatever sequence.
Oh, yeah,
in
the club. Sparkling yeah. stuff. I mean, yeah. It's so cool looking. Yeah.
And yeah. CineSite was also behind my loud hailer sequence because the flames, when you've got Ryan Gosling, they're all digital flames that have been. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's right, a ton of pyro stuff. And there's a lot of the sequence on the Sydney Harbour stuff with the boats. Some of that's totally digital, too, where the boat, like the aerial shots of the boat speeding yeah. around.
And it looked,
and that stuff's
looked
really,
great.
Really good.
Yeah.
Like
and
the
when there
boats
are shots
at night, you know, like with yep. the sort of yeah. sodium vapor. Like city lighting and stuff. It's just really, really, it looks so crisp. And I did mm-hmm. not, for a second, I did not think some of those shots were effect shots, which is such, it's cool to come back and you see the reel and you're like, oh, no way. Like what? Like that's not real. Like, and when you're watching it in the film on a big screen and you don't notice it. I mean, I think that's the ultimate testament to the work of the artist.
And the
and
slow-mo
I have to say,
pyro on one of my, Gosling when he gets lit up.
Oh,
you
yeah.
know, like.
Yeah, that's all added.
I
yeah.
know, it looks incredible.
I was going to say the other Sorry, thing when ahead, you were Matt. Talking about, no, just when you were talking about the where they're doing the one or the big, you know, they have 3 hours to shoot mm-hmm. like at the Sydney Opera House or whatever. One of my favorite parts of it, and I think it happens earlier too, is the people in the alien costumes, like in between yeah. takes, like standing and they're leaning back yes. and they're smoking cigarettes and stuff.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
so awesome. Like it's such a like real movie set vibe where like the, you know, believability and the sort of suspension mm-hmm. of disbelief that comes across on screen in between takes is just completely gone when you see like, you know, they're eating yeah. like, you know, or drinking a cup of coffee or whatever it is. So good.
I mean, I loved when Gosling broke in when he was supposed to be dead and he breaks into her trailer and he's wearing the alien outfit and he's trying to
oh,
tell
yeah,
her
the
it's
voice.
Him. And he's,
yeah.
Yeah. And he's like, rah, 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 you know, like, so you know,
I had forgotten great, that was another one jokes. Of those. Yeah. That was another one of that. Yeah. I totally agree. Okay. So shout out to the VFX team who probably are listening to this podcast and wondering why we didn't spend more on your time. And the only reason we didn't spend more talking about your shots is because they were so bloody good.
For sure.
So, we didn't know they were shots.
yeah, we didn't know they were shots. So points to you guys. And for those of you that, I mean, I presume you've got to this point in the podcast, you've actually seen it. But if you haven't, see it. If you have seen it, please, you know, recommend it to your friends because it is something that I think is worth doing. And guys, with that, let's wind it up. Jason, where can people sort of connect with you or, you know,
anywhere you can type Jason Diamond is one word into the internet, Zero Space, virtual production company, the Diamond Brothers, or our production company, and any ball of the jazz, you know.
Mr. Wallen? Professor Wallen?
Yeah, mattwallen.com. I'm on, as of 4 days from today, I will be on research leave for 7 months. And I've got all
That's
kinds
the
of
best,
fun,
isn't it?
Oh yeah, I've got so many fun things lined up, which will be really great. And I just wanted to say, there are two amazing interviews on a competing, well, not competing, another excellent podcast, the Team Deacons podcast. For any people who are into visual effects, if you're listening to the show, you must go to the Team Deacons podcast and download the last two episodes. In particular, John Knoll. Is on there mm-hmm. and it's one of the most inspiring hours of an interview with I think a truly legitimate genius John Knoll, which is just, and his story is just so great. And the humility of the guy, like he's not pompous at all. He's just so down to earth. It's so cool. And then also a really fun interview with Dennis Muren just this last week, right after John Knoll. So, you know, two real luminary figures from the history of visual effects who've been so important to the industry. They both do an hour-long interview with Roger and James Deakins, and it's fantastic.
And I should also mention, Jason, you've pinged to our internal kind of chat the Cannes 24 George Lucas talk. Do you want to just – I haven't actually seen it because you've only pinged it to me today. But
yeah, I haven't watched it yet either, but he got like an honorary Palme d'Or at Cannes this year. That
Coppola gave it to
Coppola,
him, right?
Yeah, Coppola gave him. And there's some great pictures are flying around the internet of them in like, you
embracing
know, it's a picture of them in like 1974 and them now. Like, it's awesome to see them be friends for so long. And also, if it's out of print, you can find it places. There's a great book by Michael Rubin called Droid Makers.
Oh, yes.
Droid Maker. That's a great book.
That is a phenomenal book about the two of 100%. Them specifically and their contributions to the world we live in, which are great.
Absolutely.
And that keynote from Lucas, apparently it's what, 90 minutes long?
But 90 minutes,
it's all online from Khan, which is great.
Yeah, it's on YouTube. Yeah, we'll put the link in. It's
and I have talking to say, about like, everything. Yeah. Just a side note to that, like I haven't watched it yet either. I'm so excited to see it. I mean, it's amazing. They're both in, you know, 80, right? So they're both older gentlemen, still working, have had such a massive impact on the industry. And just, you know, selfishly, like, I feel like I was so lucky, so fortunate. My first job after college was going to work at ILM and working, you know, for George. George was the owner and the boss. And never have I ever had, since my time at that job, I've never had a better boss. You know, every year at Thanksgiving, you'd get a turkey. There was a beautiful, fun Christmas party every year. And there was our holiday party. And there was a great 4th of July picnic at Skywalker Ranch. And he was just in any organization, the tone is set by the person at the top. And working at Industrial Light and Magic, all the Lucas companies from what I can, the ones I didn't work at, from what I've heard from people who weren't at ILM, the tone was set, and the tone was such a positive one, and one that was really collaborative, really highly creative and very egalitarian. And that's pretty cool, I think. So bravo, I think, to George. It's really cool that they honored him in that way.
Brilliant. Okay, so obviously I'm over at FX Guide, and we're celebrating 25 years of FX Guide, and we'll be posting links out of FX Guide of odd stories that we just remember fondly from the last 25 years. So sometimes it's people that were, you know, we're lucky enough in this industry that if we've been in it for a long time, people that were really junior when we were starting out as well are now really senior, right? When we were talking to Wes Ball recently on the new Apes film, Wes earlier in his career actually did classes for us over at FX PhD, for example, right? Like, it's just great. So some of these stories you have to, you know, like read them in the context that they were written 20 years ago. But yeah, some of them, like, I find are just fascinating, people that we've spoken to over the years. And we'll be putting up podcasts and stuff as well.
That FX podcast, I just have to say, that FX podcast with Wes Ball and Eric Winquist, that was one of the best ones ever. So good. Such rich, deep detail. I totally dug that one. It was excellent.
No, thanks, man. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I got it.
Okay, guys.
I got to do that one.
Well, thanks so much for listening. We will catch you. We've got a ton of films actually lined up to do. So we're really glad that you could join us for this one. Until next time, I'm Mike Simmel. See you guys.
If you have any questions or comments, please email us at vfx@fxguide.com. Copyright FX Guide, LLC.